Welcome to Roots and Ruminants, your podcast for creative and innovative use of farm, pasture, and rangeland. We're going back to the basics of raising and grazing livestock, growing your own forage, and practical land use.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are on to another episode of Roots and Ruminants, and we've got another international guest, actually. Jared and I are sitting down with Graham Finn. Graham is in Calgary, Alberta, up just north of us, right, Graham?
Yeah, we're actually 50 minutes north of Calgary on the foothills towards the Rocky Mountains. We can see them from our back door.
And you do not have a Canadian accent.
Yeah, not yet. Been here 30 years, yet. Still working on it. Yeah, still working on it. Just the smart people can change their accent, the dummies can't. So, yeah.
Stuck. That's a good thing. Yeah. So this is a pretty cool podcast, and the fact that obviously Graham's got a ton of knowledge and a ton of experience being a rancher producer in Canada, but his background is extremely diverse and just a boatload of knowledge we're going to dig into. But the other relevant fact of having Graham as a guest on the podcast is Graham works for Union Forage, and Millborn Seeds just recently acquired Union Forage in Canada. And so we thought this was pretty timely to go ahead and get him on to talk about all things related to what he's doing up in Canada. We spent a week there last week learning all the things that they're doing as far as some different swath grazing techniques, the forage mixes they have. And there's going to be some awesome things in terms of what they are doing and bringing some of that knowledge back into the States with our producers too. So I'm really excited for that part.
Yeah, super excited for that, you know, being able to share notes and ideas and stuff and get more producers on both sides of the border aware of what's going on in either direction. So really excited.
Do you want to start off from square one? So you're not a Canadian originally, right? You grew up in Australia. Do you want to kind of give us your background and how you got to where you are right now?
Yep. Yeah, Jared's right. You know, if we can shut those borders down a little bit more and be more coherent,
collaborative.
Collaborative is the word. Yep, because it's the same country. If it wasn't for that line across there and the cattle industry, we need to work together with the way the times are. So, you're totally right. But I turned 60 this year, and I've been in Canada 30 years. So I was 30 years in Australia and 30 years here. I grew up on a property in far western Queensland on my dad's side. It was just under 500,000 acres, about 15,000 cows, 4,000 or 5,000 females, and then backgrounding cattle as well, grass cattle as you guys call them, and then we had on the other side was all sheep. That was pretty big, 10,000 wool cutting merinos, super fine wool, on my mum's side, and so when I finished high school, I went to Ag College in New South Wales and then started heading my life. Worked on a couple of big cattle stations. Well, I came to Canada. I managed a couple of places in Australia, and then the last place I managed was a purebred Hereford operation. And we came up to Agribition, which is, you know, a really large winter show up here in Canada and in North America too, in Regina, and looking at buying some semen embryos to take back to Aussie. And then we did that, and then the old boy is fifth generation. He died 18 months later, so I came back up to Canada in 93. And then just for a holiday, and I got laid off anyway. The people who bought the property, they didn't need a manager, so I just came up here for a holiday, ended up staying. The guy got employed by the guy I was working for, and he employed me for 2 years for indentured service for my PR card, permanent residency, and then it kind of evolved from there, and the opportunities up here back then were really good because land was way cheaper, good soil, great rainfall. Been through droughts in Australia that just tear your heart to pieces watching livestock perish or your bank account perish, one of the two. And then kind of made a start, and I met my wife 6 years into that, and she's regretted it ever since. So, yeah.
So Hereford cattle, was that back on the home station too, back when you were growing up, or that was just a, yep?
We had Brahman, Angus, Brangus. I was in the tropics up north. Yeah. And so that was, they were Brahman base, the greys and the reds, and then the true to type Brahmins. And then you had your Brangus and Brafords and yada, 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 you know, them, Jared. And so I worked for the third largest property in the world as their stud manager, was Newcastle Water Station in the Northern Territory. That was 10,300 square kilometres. That's almost from Calgary to cross the Saskatchewan border, right down to the Montana border and back up through the Rockies and stuff, how big that place was. And we had 30,000 cows on that place at commercials, and we had 10,000 purebred cows on that place. And then there was actually 130 commercials on that place and 10,000 purebreds on that place. So, and then we had the backgrounders, and we used to drove them between properties as they started to put on weight. We'd drove them to the next station, which had better grass than where we were at, so on and so on. So it's still, you know, the droving days are still prime in Australia. There's still a lot of droving going on, and it's kind of the mainstay there now. Like, you can drove instead of trucking, you take, you know, 10, 12, 15 days to drove them from one side to the other. Try to do about 10 kilometers a day, just slowly, just grazing and walking, and then to a night camp, which is set up with electric fencing, and camp the night and let them out daylight, and away you go. So yeah, it's still done a lot in Australia.
That's fascinating. I had no idea actually that still existed. We talk about cattle drives in the United States from Montana to Texas, and that's kind of what I'm thinking about. But like, so is this just one area in Australia that's still like that, or is it
go all the north area? Yeah, Northern Australia, West, like Queensland, WA, and then Northern Territory. So Western Australia, Northern Territory, Queensland, and then the top end, like we call it the top end. And so that would be the biggest ones. And then down south, they'd be had small, smaller days. You know, you drove from one of your properties to another, and might be 3 or 4 days. At Tamworth, we drove in New South Wales, the last place I managed before I came here. We drove 4 days to the high country. So we just put them on the road and took 4 days quietly, just walking them. The thing was, if you start losing weight, you're not doing your job properly on those cattle. So it's just slowly walking. And they would take them to the high country for the summer and then bring them back down to low country for the winter. So that was, it's still done quite prevalently. You can look it up. There's the largest cattle drive ever done was just you can look it up. It was done way before COVID, but it was there was 100,000 head driven from Queensland all the way down to Victoria. A guy bought cattle because of the drought and just put them on the road and drove them slowly down to his irrigation place in Victoria, and that was the largest cattle drive ever. It was a world record. Yeah.
Wow.
Sounds peaceful.
Yeah, it is. It would. No phones, nothing back then. It's a great place to train dogs and horses, because all you're doing is slowly walking, and you can put miles on a horse and get them all mouthed up really well. And it is. And then you sit at night and, you know, cook over a fire and have a few beers, and there's only about 3 or 4 years. There's not a lot. And because you've all got, you know, 5 or 6 dogs, so, you know, you don't need a lot of guys.
Huh.
It is peaceful. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was good times. I'd hate to do it now, because you're sleeping out every night in a cot or on the ground, and, you know, it's good for young guys. Old guys like you, us three here, it'd be pretty tough.
You don't think I drove very well. I don't think I'd do very well to drove at this age. So you just get permission, right? So you just get permission from neighboring properties and just say, hey, I want to be on your land with all my cattle for a while.
Put them on the road. They're on what they call stock routes. So if you look at a map of Australia, look up stock routes, there's maps, and they're government owned land, which are about half a mile wide. So it'll be from your front gate, Jared, say, down to, Colorado, Denver or something, and just drove them. They're allocated. They are called stock routes. They don't go through anybody's land at all. Huh. So you go out your front gate, then you turn left or turn right, and then away you go. And then you just drove them. You have to do 10K a day because they don't want it overgrazed. So there might be guys coming in behind you, right? So
maybe rather than a carbon pipeline coming through, we should advocate and lobby for a stock route.
Stock routes.
I mean, think of this. The beauty of this and the grass we can grow, we could put pollinators in the stock routes.
Yeah. People could probably pheasant hunt in it when they're not stock, there's no stock there. Yeah.
There's so much food go to waste, and up here in Canada they pay guys to go and mow it with Schulte mowers. And I don't know how much, probably $175 an hour or whatever it is. And man, they could have sheep and cattle droving, and they're fertilizing the soil too, and then they're not overgrazing it, and it'll help the producers out big time. But we don't drove. We let them out our back gate here, and they go 2 miles down the road like last year. And we got a dog on a chain at one end, a dog on a chain at this end, and the dog stopped and going too far until we get the grass chewed down there, and then we let them back in again.
It's like required, like you're required to have water, water every so often too, then obviously.
The government supplied, they're all windmills. So these stock routes, they've got, look at it tonight when you get home, they've got windmills every 10 miles or 10 kilometers. It's 10 miles, I think it's back now in the old Imperial management, but there's windmills there into tanks, into troughs. So that was put up hundreds of years ago, and they're still maintained. Not hundreds, 150 years ago they were put up probably, and they're still maintained on those stock routes because it's crown land, but it's for drought relief and cattle movements, especially in the old days when they had no semis and stuff like that. Like thousands of cattle were driven all over Australia. And the Chisholm, like your droving days only last about 30, 40 years. The big cattle drives of the West and all that they talk about, ours are still going down there.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. That's awesome. Okay, so
that could be a whole other podcast.
I'd say we could do a whole podcast on stock routes, but we probably should.
Actually change topic.
This is session one with Graham. Part of a 12-part series that will extend through the next 3 years.
All bullshit, nothing guaranteed. Yeah,
that's good. What? So fast forward, and then maybe we'll probably move back a little bit from here even yet. But Graham, tell us about Union Forage.
Okay. Well, yeah, we kind of go back a couple of steps, and I our place is a year-round grazing operation. We graze 365 days a year. We don't put up any feed except for swath grazing in the wintertime. We lay it down, leave it in the paddocks and move fence. And then we've got perennial pasture stands. And when I was at college, one of my majors was beef and forages. When I came here, I wanted to know, it was like coming to a whole other, well, it was coming to a whole other country and a whole other system, and I wanted to connect with the right people, and I couldn't find the people that couldn't read it out of a manual, like you two guys, producers yourselves. Trying to talk to producer is really good because they'll tell you the mistakes, but then you talk to a seed rep and they read out of the manual. And that manual's perfect. It's like the Holy Grail. You never make a mistake when you read out of a manual. And so I was doing perennials. I had that kind of figured out. And then my annuals for swaths were just oats and triticale. And I wanted a better feed. And I wanted to keep my calves on longer and not sell in November when the fall run was on. And so I was talking to a good friend of all of ours, is John Snyder, who's since passed away here a couple of years ago, and he was shining light for me to try and figure out, my winter program, and he made me think back And I never thought back. I'd always thinking forward. And he said, you guys surely would have used brassicas in Australia. And I said, oh, shit, yeah, we used them all winter. That's, you know, we use swedes and turnips for winter grazing and so on. So he said, well, why aren't you using, you know, brassicas in your swaths? And I holy shit. And that's where it was a light going on, thinking, God, I've got to stop looking forward and look back and see what I can tweak back there to bring forward and make it all happen. So John gave us 9 bags of Winfred forage rape, and that went down in the swaths, and I had forage rape and triticalian oats, and then kind of started from there, and my neighbors saw it, and they said, well, get me a couple of bags, and that one 2007 John, that one nine bags of seed turned into a pallet, turned a couple of pallets, and under then it was Southern Cross Livestock, and my wife said, I'm done with CFIA. So you do something, I take it off the farm. And so that's, we kind of started Union Forage, and I was just doing brassicas only and annual mixes before it was called cover crops. It was, to me, it was nutrient-dense forage. I didn't give a shit about soil health, and it's low on my priority list. John was helping me, and we partnered up with PGG and the guys from IOCA, and we kind of started there, and then I had another partner who was into the perennials, and then we kind of formed Union Forage, and then that partner went his own way and did something different, and then we stayed with Union Forage, and then my partners we got it bigger and better than on the farm here, but we did really well. Like, we officially started Union Forage 10 years ago, and it's kind of done quite well, and the key to us is all the owners are producers, and we're walking the walk and making the mistakes, so that's kind of how that started. And we got a warehouse in Calgary. And then Jeff Barker, our general manager, he's an Aussie too, and he took the reins there and did everything properly instead of kind of Mickey Mouse like I did it with paperwork. But, yeah, that's kind of where it started. And then this whole movement started with soil health and, you know, save the planet. And I'm thinking, holy geez, guys, you know, this regenerative agriculture, sustainability, kind of thing, and resilient, and all these buzzwords are coming in. And geez, don't forget about the livestock guys. You still got to feed them and do the best dollar you can on those, because, you know, it's we're an industry of price takers, not price setters. And everybody talks about, you know, I got X amount of cents per pound per my calf, and they say, oh, that's great, but how much did it cost you? And they go, not really sure. And I say, well, geez, it cost me $1.27 through the winter. That's, I'm really proud of that. And that's where you make your margins. So it's kind of where it's evolved from there. And yeah, I think sometimes we have to look backwards, back into history and see how they did it back then. And my dad's family is from the west coast of Ireland. And I think I was telling Justin this story the other day, but it's really relevant to way we're going now. They were what they call crofter farmers, and they were Irish Catholic, and they lived on the west coast on rock, and they had peat bog, and they had the kelp on the beach, and they used to bring that back to their little farm, and they'd get the cattle eating it, the pigs and everything, and so what they didn't eat, they trampled into the soil, and what they did eat, they shit out and pissed on the soil and got that all nutrient flow there. And, you know, today we'd call that resilient and regenerative agriculture, and back then it was called frickin' survival agriculture. You know, had to feed the family, had to, you know, do things outside the box, and I think we do need to look back a bit and see how that kind of works. And they did this long before we, or some people came and said, oh, look what we're doing now, it's a miracle.
Yeah, it is a little bit it can feel a little condescending sometimes watching some people from outside of agriculture just be like, ha, look, you guys never even thought about this. It was like, yeah, no, I bet we have. You know,
right on. Yeah.
Going back to, I remember this conversation, I probably brought this up in the podcast before, but I was talking with somebody 2 years ago who was really, you know, kind of an urban person, and they were really getting into regenerative farming for the first time. And they were telling me all about how they were going to start butchering their own chickens. And it was all this kind of stuff, you know, and how it's kind of a lecture, right? Like, ended up lecturing me for about a half an hour about how that, you know, people should be more in touch with where their food comes from. They should engage with their neighborhood and that kind of stuff. This was a person that was doing some professional coaching with me. And then he's like, you know, have you ever thought about doing this? And I was like, we always have. Like, we butcher our own chickens every year. He's like, when did you start? It's like, I don't think we ever stopped. Like, I think we started thousands of years ago, probably, or whenever we got domesticated chickens, you know, like, so we've been doing it my whole life. And I'm pretty sure every one of my ancestors' whole life, you know, kind of thing like, oh, you should start. Would you start doing this? Like, no, we just skipped the part where we stopped doing it.
Yeah. Exactly. And we teach our kids, and they're going to teach their kids who stay on the farm. And even the ones who leave, they'll probably come back because that was a fun day. Blood and guts everywhere. And, you know, so chickens running around with their heads cut off.
Right. Yep. That's
Getting so removed.
You know, there's an entire group of people that say that term, like run around like a chicken with their head cut off. They've never actually seen a chicken with their head cut off running around. You know, like, do they even know what that means?
Yeah. Imagine the vegans just reeling right
great
now.
Great humor. Great. It's great humor. But yeah. No, it is. Look, I'm glad. There's a lot of ways I'm glad that there's a renewed attention and focus and positivity around, you know, this way of raising livestock and farming and that kind of stuff. But yeah, sometimes it can be a little bit much. Sometimes if you go on LinkedIn, you can really like, that's enough of that for a while.
Yep. Yeah, and it makes you depressed. Like, you think, geez, guys, don't you understand what we're doing here? You know, we're not doing this. This is a business. Yeah. It's just like you owning a fruit and veg stand or a coffee stand or whatever in town. You know, it's a business, and we don't. Do you abuse your coffee beans? You know, you've got them temperature controlled in an area in the back of the shop. There, they're not just sitting out on the back in the weather and everything like this. And that's how we run our operations. You know, animal welfare is top of the list, because you start abusing the cattle, they'll start abusing your back. So, you know, our cattle love being around us. Like, we've had visitors come here and the cattle just mob you and they kind of scared. They go, oh. But no, once they get chilled, like they chill, the cattle are there and they just can't believe it. And it's a happy life. Like, even the calves, you know.
Well, which, I mean, we try in lots of different ways. Like I said, I think we're in a better spot now. The state of the public perception of the cow is in a better state than it was 10 or 15 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. We have strong, loud, vocal, mainstream voices of people that are saying, yeah, like, I not only do I eat beef, I eat almost nothing but beef, and I think it's the, you know, the best food that I can eat, both for my health and for how it's raised in the environment. Right. Well, that wasn't happening 20 years ago when I was in college. Right? You know.
I want to go back to what you said about grazing 365 days a year and spend some time there. Just, I mean, I think as a cow-calf producer, everybody's trying to make sure that their cattle are grazing longer, because the longer they graze, the less they have for expenses into them.
Yep.
So one thing that, and I had mentioned this to you too, you know, we talk about grazing corn, and I said, well, our corn stalks are our cheapest resource grazing in the fall and early winter. We try to stay on those as long as possible. And you had said, what do you mean grazing corn? Like, and I said, oh, after it's combined. And you're like, oh yeah, well, we graze standing corn, but we don't graze combined corn. So I think that's one of the major differences. But can you talk through the plan that you set up for folks when somebody comes to you and says, all right, Graham, I've got some perennial pasture and I've got some farmland that I want to put some annuals in. How do you walk through a successful plan to make sure that they graze as long as possible?
So first of all, I make them understand electric fencing. Like, you know, it's when I do workshops and stuff, and the biggest thing is, let's build an electric fence and get to understand how handy electric fencing is. Even if you're going down this regenerative agricultural path, the first thing is understand electric fencing first. know how portable it is and how handy it is, that can be your first step into regenerative agriculture. So guys have said, oh, I tried electric fencing once, it didn't work, and it doesn't work here in Canada, or blah, blah, blah. It turns out they had one ground rod and it was mild steel instead of galvanized, and the energizer was just a cheap, you know, $100 energizer. And if you're going to start, I would make sure we understand electric fencing first, how it works. More ground rods are better. Have an oversized energizer, especially for up here, because when the ground freezes, we get air pockets in the soil. So the conductivity, you guys know, it doesn't conduct as well as what it does in the summertime. Yeah. Once we got that figured out, then we can start talking about, you know, how we're going to do this for winter and summer. So I'm big on rotational grazing in cells. I don't want to go all summer moving break fences all summer. I do that enough in the wintertime. So we get Google Earth Pro and we start mapping out where their water site is and you know, where the cells can go off that. There's a lot of people that – some guys down in northern US say, you know, put water in every paddock. At home, our cattle used to walk 5 miles each direction to go to water. And that's why we had the Bos Indicus. You wouldn't want to do that with the Bos Taurus breeds, but we fitted the cattle to the landscape. And so we've just got laneways and we've got a section of land with one water on it. And they walk a mile and a half to water. And, that's great. The cows are exercised. They're not having issues through the wintertime. They're being overfat. We try to keep them in 3+ body score. So the perennial side is really easy. You know, sandpoint vetch and alfalfa, orchard grass, softleaf fescue, intermediate wheatgrass. If you're out in the eastern Alberta and Saskatchewan, like mix the forages up, but always keep the tap-rooted legumes in there. And then the wintertime is a little more difficult because the drier areas in Saskatchewan, you know, can't grow what I can over here in the foothills. So, you know, you were going for more sorghum, sunflowers, triticalian oats, and maybe one forage rape and 40-10 peas. Over here, I can have no sorghums, no sunflowers because I'm 4,200 feet above sea level. My summers are short. So I kind of, you mix and match to everybody's operation. And then once the guy's over this hurdle that saying, oh, I get too much snow, I can't graze that much, and my cows won't graze through that much snow, mate, once you've trained them, you'll be amazed. You can't even see the heads. The heads are buried. What did livestock do before white fellas came along? They did quite well without us. So we were able to, you know, we select the hardiest of our heifers. Lately we've sold early because the price has been really well. So I've let the calves go in November, December instead of January, February. And so the economics said, geez, why keep them when they're getting, you know, when we're getting $2,600, $2,800 calves and all this sort of stuff. So we got rid of them. So we're very liquid that way. But the replacement heifers that we keep off those cows, well, I've got two different swath grazing paddocks and they're about 4 miles apart. So the heifer calves from paddock A go across to B and the B calves go across to A, and we're managing them and monitoring them exactly how their rest of their life is going to be. Moving fence every morning, getting used to electric fencing, blah, blah, blah. And we make our selections before they even go to a bull. And so we're seeing how they're performing. If they're starting to lose weight through the winter, then we know right away they're not staying in. They can go over to the grass program and finish off grass and we sell them off to beef. But the ones that stay in, we've got a closed cow herd. And so the ones that stay in, they perform. And that genetic line gets stronger and stronger, to the point now where we're selling heifers. It's funny, the phone's ringing. It's the Gallagher dealer, the Gallagher rep for Gallagher.
Electric fence plug.
Good plug. Yeah.
Yeah, our local area manager for Gallagher is just calling. But he doesn't know what's going on today. I'll have to give him a call. But anyway, he owes me a free Energizer. Anyway, so that that scenario has built this herd really strong, where now we're selling heifers off to guys who want to, you know, we're black baldies, Angus Hereford crosses, who want to, you know, have a bit of a tougher female. And then we in the spring, or we join in end of July. So breeding season is 40 days, July until end of August kind of thing. And those heifers are going to the same bulls as the cows. Sure, I got low birth weight bulls, which, you know, that's fine with me, you know, really long angular kind of bulls. But I don't want to have them and us kind of groups in my cattle herd. And that's looking back from when we were younger, is like when you've got over 100,000 head of cattle, of cows, and the breeding program, you know, you try to select your bulls right and cross your fingers and do all that good stuff, and it usually works out, and the weak get weaker and you don't want them around anyway. So that building that forage up was the base to help these females continue on as best as what they can. And we've just winter grazing, it can be done probably as far as south as you, Justin, I think, for a shorter period of time, but we're still out there right now winter grazing. The spring is our biggest challenge because it starts bogging up with the thaw. They're bogging half the feed into the ground, so you got to move the fence twice a day instead of once a day. Give them half in the morning, half at night kind of thing, but that's kind of the challenge. But I think just once you've got a recipe that works for you, you don't need 20 freaking species in your feed. You've got to keep your budget in line and keep it as, you know, five work for you. That's great. And you're still getting energy levels in the mid-60s and the proteins in the 14s or 13, 14, 15s. That's all a cow needs to maintain at 40 below. So on our place, you know, the finances is first, economical, and so we're viable on the farm. Animal health and welfare is third, and soil health is last. And integrating that, it'll improve our soil because, you know, we are reducing our inputs from fertility, but it will always have a starter fertilizer to get it going, to get those seedlings going. So we've cut it down from probably $120 an acre to $47 an acre last year. So, but it took time, you know. It took time, like 10 years to get it down like that. So
are you planting that mix first thing in the spring then, letting it grow up all summer and then stockpiling it and then grazing it in the wintertime? Is that the plan?
Yep. Yeah. So we're seeding July. So great question, Jared. So we're seeding in June, around June 10th to 15th.
Okay.
So I still do use chem. So what I do, so we've got three passes on our paddock. We've got a harrow because I'm trying to stimulate weed in May. Okay. Actually four passes. So I've got a big pasture harrow I bought out of the UK, and it's just it's got a big frame. It wings up and 3-point linkage, and it's got these round harrow kind tines that are all linked together like chains. And so I'm just lightly skiffing that soil to try and get the red root pigweed, the wild oats, you know, anything we can get to germinate. Then I'll hit it with Roundup. And then I'll go and seed, and then we'll swath. So in April, we'll go and late April, early May, we'll go and harrow. And then we'll go and wait for weed stimulation, and we'll go and spray. And then we'll go and use the direct seeding drill, like zero till, put the cereal down in between June 10th and June 15th, and then the swather, which a neighbor comes in and does for $17 an acre, will do that around about the first week in September, Jared. So, yeah, the total cost for that is about $215 an acre with seed and fertilizer. but our feeding costs this year is $127. I mean, $1.27 a day per cow.
A day.
Yep. Okay. Yep. So that's like the Alberta average is $3.80 on the government website. Oh,
wow. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So it's a lot. So,
you said that the spring is the hardest time for swath grazing, and I get that, right? That's our hardest time to feed on fields as well here too. What else? Where do you see failures for swath grazing? Where do you see it go wrong?
The guys who don't pay attention to their weeds. So, you know, this cover crop thing right now is just gone ballistic with false narratives all over the place. Like if you're getting a weed issue, just grow oats, you know, for a year, to in-crop spray MCPA 24D AP 24D amine, whatever, just to get those. Don't let the overwhelming of soil health and no chemical inputs overtake you, because all of a sudden, you know, you're going to have a weed pile and you're going to be buying in feed. There's so many people out there, and we know a couple of them up here in Canada, and they're just, you know, don't use inputs and don't use this and that. Mate, I went down that. In 2015, I stopped using fertilizer after listening to a guy in North Dakota, and so I've been swath grazing on that land since 2003, right BSE time, and then so we had a lot of nutrient, and it's that piece of land had been has been in my wife's family for 123 years, so it was intensively cropped before that, because they were croppers on that side, and then they started seeing the yields go down, and then we bought the cattle on. So we increased our organic matter from 2.8 to 9.2, but that took us nearly 15 years to get that. And then I thought, holy smokes, you know, now I can cut fertilizer after listening to these people. And anyway, in 2015, we stopped using fertilizer. And then 15, 16, 17, great years, good rain, good crops. 18, good rain, not too bad. 19, it all started imploded. And I just, over those 5 years, I just mined the fatty. Even though those cattle were still synchronizing, we all know nitrogen moves in the soil, phos stays, but my nitrogen levels were crashing because we had such a, you know, we still had our 4010 peas inoculated. We still had the cattle shitting and pissing all over the soil, plus the other plants that were rotting in into the soil. But we're a high, high factory there, and we're taking a lot of nutrients out and not replacing enough. And I rang the guy and said, look, you know, what's happening here? Like, I got urine spots, and that told me right away I was nitrogen deficient. He said, oh, looks like you need a little nitrogen there. I said, man, you've just been telling everybody you don't use fertilizers, and well, I always keep a tool in my toolbox. And so that afternoon I put nitrogen down at it was about 70 pounds an acre, within 11 days I recovered that crop straight away. And so now my two most important tools I use on the farm is a good nutritionist, a good agronomist. So I always do feed tests, and I always do soil tests, because you know what they say, you can't measure what you don't measure. So, yeah.
Spot on. There's so many people that think that if you just plant a cover crop, well, now I can forget about farming. Well, it's
part of freaking hell.
Yeah. The agronomic basics of farming still have to exist when you have cover crop, otherwise.
And where's this? Where has this gone, Justin? Where is this knowledge gone? It's just.
Well, I think you know you swing for the fences, right? And in order to really promote something, people are exaggerating the facts of it. And so you talk about, no fertilizer, no chemical programs with cover crops. You can get by with that for, like what you're saying, it can happen for a few years. But at some point, you've got to look at what your system has. And that's no different than, like, my dad always says, you can't starve the profits out of a cow, you know, but with your feed costs. And so it's no different than your soil. You know, at some point, if you don't have enough legumes that are just staying on the soil and just fixing nitrogen, when you're taking something off, something has to go back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we're getting away from those basics. And this is what I was saying earlier. Like, we're forgetting what history our grandparents and our great grandparents did. And, you know, it wasn't they couldn't afford it. They knew that was good management. And livestock rotation in any system, doesn't matter, you know, if you're a soy guy or a corn or a wheat and barley up here, or a canola is king. Well, it was king. Now canola price had dropped like an anchor. But these guys should be taking advantage of these low prices of canola and working with their cattle neighbor to come over and graze on that land for a couple of years, you know, bring that back into balance. It will take more than a couple of years, of course, but at least it's a start. And you're right on. Like, you know, we're forgetting the basics that are we not teaching it anymore in universities? I don't know, mate. Like, it's just it's not all science and rockets going forward and ponies and rainbows, because we can do it on a data sheet and punch in any number on the computer we want. And then says, holy shit, if we do this, we should be able to do that. Yeah, but we're playing with Mother Nature here. Do you think she's got a data sheet she looks at and says, holy, you know, we should be doing this today? Yeah, no, we're not going to have rain. We're going to have not rain for another 3 months. But, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a far swinging pendulum, right? And so I think what happens is that there we probably have, I mean, in certain areas and in certain practices and way we're doing things, been sucked a little bit into the big agro-industrial, hey, this is what you should do. All you got to do is buy the top tier of all of our stuff over and over and over again, and you're good to go, right? And so the pushback is too far to where, like, no, none, right? Not going to do any fertilizer, no chemical, you know, no GMO seed, that kind of stuff. It's like, well, the right probably blend is the same where be in the middle, pull the tools off of either side where you can, right? That's thinking, that's managing, right? Instead of either one is a knee-jerk reaction and kind of, absolving the decisions to others.
Yeah. And you're right on, because we were pounded from one end, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every presentation you went to at a conference, it had, the little logo down the bottom, you know, Union Forage, Melbourne Seed, whatever. And there was hardly any researchers or guys like us sitting up there and say, look, it's not all ponies and rainbows. This is the problems I had. I learned more off the guys who tell me they had problems rather than guys that, you know, I did this and all of a sudden it's a miracle, evangelical bloody tones. I'd rather talk to the guys that make those mistakes and said, yeah, that didn't work for me, you know, but I've gone back to using a bit of fertilizer just to get it started. And so that's why, you know, it's confusing for producers, because they're hearing it now from one extreme on one side and the other extreme on the other. And they've just got to join a group of like-minded farmers and set up an association or a club or something that they can – they're kind of building on local knowledge within their area and good producers.
Yeah, but I think those two camps, like you said, are a bit too extreme. And so the no spent money on anything camp is a bit too extreme too, right? Like we've been to presentations like that. Like even the seed companies that we're talking about representing here, you know, Melbourne Union Forage, look, we're selling basically for the most part non-varietal protected stuff. I mean, almost everything, most of the things, half the things that we sell, you know, if it wasn't for state seed laws or country seed laws, you could keep back and raise it yourself. It's not like we have, you know, tech agreements that are 40 pages long to buy our products. But there's still folks that'll attack, you know, if we're up in a presentation, like, wow, you're representing your seed company. It's like, well, yeah, this is our value proposition. This is what we bring to the table. Some of those larger companies just have to do it to a bigger degree. And we set this, the farmers set the stage for them. And didn't really, you know, complain a whole lot when they said, hey, just go ahead, here's the microphone, you can have it. We wanted to put we wanted a free lunch. We didn't want to pay for a speaker at our, you know, local corn grower meeting. And so, hey, look who's willing to come. They'll pay for lunch. All they want to do is talk for half an hour. And we did that for like 20, 30 years. And after that, we're just conditioned to it. That's just like, this is all we have left.
Well, you just gave me a top. When I come down there, I'll charge you for coming to speak.
No, but anyway, we could go on and on about this, but yeah, I think it's a pendulum swinging too far. To just quit everything cold turkey and go
common
completely
sense.
The other way.
Yeah. Just common sense. And baby steps. When someone comes into this program and they say, well, I had a guy last week and he wants to do 400 acres of cover crops. I said, have you ever done this before? And he was in the eastern Alberta, so it's kind of a little dry. No, but I've been doing a lot of reading and watching YouTube, which is the worst thing out, YouTube. And so I said, well, we're going to do 100 acres of a cover crop and the rest is going to be oats. Oh, but that's not doing soil health. I said, yeah, but you don't even know what your soil even needs because you haven't measured anything. And to go and put, 400 acres down and then we have a major drought and it's cost you X amount of dollars per acre, I don't think you could absorb that cost at the end of the year. So let's do this and then the rest in oats and we can lay that down. You can still graze oats. Maybe if we have a really good year, then you can use the cover crop end closer to calving and up the feed quality a bit. And so you've got your lower quality moving across your paddocks. And when you get to, 2 months before calving, then you're on your better plane of nutrition rise. So, these kind of things, and they all know this. Producers aren't dumb. They've just kind of, have we forgotten? Because we've been dug into this narrative of we're just getting bombarded with the media with it. So baby steps is a great way to start, whatever you do.
What you're also doing, Graham, from a consultative approach is figuring out their whole system, right? Like you just mentioned, what are the economics of this? What is if everything goes bad, what is left on the table for them? And then thinking about the cow's nutritional needs and what stage she is and when you're going to be grazing it. Like that's the whole system approach that somebody needs to be taking with producers or producers need to be thinking about, on their own. Like it's got to fit together with crop rotations and your cattle cycle in terms of their nutritional requirements.
They're the ones that are making your money, and you can help them make you money by keeping your input costs down. And if you're a grain guy and livestock, man, you've perfect. A lot of guys do it. The crop and cattle rotation. There's a lot of guys up here that into canola. Their rotation is canola, snow, canola, But if they could work with a young producer, especially these young guys that are starting off, it's tough. You guys know, like, the land prices. Like, this first place we bought here, we paid $380 an acre for it. We just lost a bid here up the road, and that was 22 years ago. It was 380. We just lost a bid on a quarter section land up here with $1.4 million. So it was nearly $7,000 an acre. So,
oh my goodness!
Yeah. So I feel for these young people coming in, if they can make the mortgage payments from the cattle, that's going to be good for them. But who's going to feed the family? So someone on the family farm is going to have to go off, either the husband or the wife is going to go off to feed the family. What is wrong with this system? Because here we are at home working 7 days a week to feed the world, but then someone from the farm has to go off 5 days a week, and when they're home, they're working the other 2 days to feed the family farm. Like, it doesn't make sense. Our commodities, like, we can push that bottom line down, but we have to get fair trade in with the packers and the fruit and veg guys and all these bulk, Loblaws and I don't know who you got down there, but be paid what we produce, and they want us to save the environment at the same time too. Yeah. Getting off topic here.
No, it's okay.
Good challenge.
Good
thing we're up for it.
I think we can do both. Actually, I think the system that we're talking about is pretty adept at doing both. So in Canada, for the most part, and this is maybe painting with too broad of a brush, but in Alberta for sure, is an operation generally either, a crop farm or a livestock or a cow-calf operation, or are there a lot of integration of both in the same operation?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jared. Yeah, like some areas, it's regional too. Like up in the northern Alberta, in the Peace, if they're grain, they're grain. Yeah. massive grain farms up there, and then eastern Canada here. I don't know how they carry their debt, but there's very little that are mixed operations. The big ones, the littler ones are more mixed operations where you've got a bit of grain, a bit of cattle. And generally in the history books, when cattle prices are up, grain was down, and then vice versa. When cattle prices were down, grain was up. Now you're getting that cross flow. One business is subsidizing the other business, you know, but lately they've been on the constant rise together. But like the guys who master this can have livestock and grain integration together up here are the really, really good switched on Hutterite colonies. Man, they're nailing it. They got the labor force, fair enough. They've got big, it's corporations. Now they're taxed up here as corporations now. Before they weren't, they were taxed as religion. But those guys have adapted and they see the benefits of these systems integrating together with the livestock. So we can have an annual cropping, canola, wheat, corn, whatever, soy. And then next year they'll have livestock integration on it, and they'll have an annual crop in there, and they'll keep, you know, cattle crop rotations. And those guys have really adopted this. I admire these guys so much. They've really figured out how to do it. And we can scale it down to smaller operations like all of us three and have that system if we want to go in the cropping business. One of my old lecturers said, do the best you can, pick a topic and do the best you can. And we've picked cattle. And sure, you know, cattle go up and down, but at least when the cattle are up, I'm not feeding the grain side of the business and having big payments on machinery. Mm-hmm. And that old guy, just I've stuck by that method myself. I'm going to be in the livestock business, and I'm not going to venture into the grain side of things because I don't know it all that well. I don't have those bigger pockets for the machinery. And with the price of fuel and everything going up, I like the cattle prices are really good right now. And you just pay off more of your mortgage or put more away for a rainy day fund. It can be really good. Like livestock are definitely, hang on to the cow's tail, she'll drag you through, you know the saying. Yeah. It's a challenge. That's the biggest challenge these days for young people. Like, you know, how are they going to get their foot in the door? And they want to be on the farm. The farm has to be bought out. So, like my kids, it'll just be four directors. And there's 14 and 17 year on their directors on our place. So they're going to just wheel through. But the first dividend check is going, you know, has to come to mum and dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there are lots of unique ways to do it. You got to get creative. You got to think outside the box, you know, whether you're starting or you're the second generation of it.
Yep.
We've had a lot of talks about that on this podcast too. It's just the communication of it all and making sure both parties are satisfied moving forward. I think there's a lot of positivity in your culture right now. And so I think that's something that we continue to promote through this podcast with different opportunities with livestock and grazing. And man, what a better spot to start as far as, you know, a low capital investment where if you can find a land lease and you want to run livestock and you're not afraid to work, labor is usually the limiting factor of this whole system. And so that's where the young folk have the advantage, is put a little bit of sweat equity into a system like this and run some electric fence and you're probably going to be just fine.
So the Canadian cow herd's been diminished significantly over the last 15, 20 years, right?
6%. 6%.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's getting back to Justin's point there. Our operation, we only have 2 quarters of land, but we rent 1,600. So Justin was right on. You don't have to own the land. You can be a tenant farmer, right? And you can work with Jared, who's a cropping guy who doesn't want to get involved in cattle. So let's have a partnership, and Jared appreciates what the shit and piss that's coming on the soil, and he gets you to rotate around and charge very minimal for land rent, because we should be we should be charging the grain guy for all that fertility. Dr. Bart Lardner out of U of S in Saskatchewan there, he's got great data on the amount, 700-something pounds of nitrogen per year that a cow, one cow, will bring per acre of land, you know. So I should say to Jared, hey, mate, you know, I'm bringing this on your land. You want X amount of dollars for rent. Let's see how we can work this out, you know. And that'll help young people, for sure.
Do you see any signs of the cow herd expanding in Canada right now with prosperity?
Or canola's dumped like nothing else. You know, oh, these guys. It's gone from $21 to $23 a bushel down to, I think, now $11 or $13. I can't remember. Do you know, Justin?
I don't know. Yeah. That is.
Huh. Yeah, it's just tanked right now. So there's going to be a bit of an upswing, but personally, I don't want to see an upswing. Like, keep the cow herd as it is now, because we go up, people start buying in, and then it starts crashing the market, because now we've got guys that are just buying Mickey Mouse cows and half-ass running them properly, and they're doing more damage than good. You know, if here in Canada, if we kept the cow numbers as is, because the killing size has gone up, like the weight, so really the production is not down, because we're getting heavier, more, you know, those F1s, you know, the Charolais, Hereford Angus cross calves come through, or the Charolais Angus or something like that, and those terminal calves, the European sires, coming across those British-based cows. So the cow numbers are down, but the kill production is actually up. So we're doing things more efficiently, to your point, you know. That's, we're looking after our soil better, the herd health is better, the animal production is better. So, you know, all the ticks are there for us to save the planet. And now we're getting, if it's not carbon, it's methane. If it's not methane, there'll be something else. And it just seems to be a rolling stone. But every time we set a target, we meet that target, and we try to do the best we can.
Yeah.
You know,
so all the emissions factors and all the calculations are done. Things that either have to be, affected or managed by activities, by societal civilization's activities for it to count. Right. So if you have a wildlife refuge, just 1,000 acres, and you go out and you burn that, you know, do a controlled burn out there, but it's not associated with with the cattle supply chain. It's not really emissions, because there's nowhere to put that. But if it was pasture, you know, then all of a sudden it'd be an emissions factor, right? Because if there was cows out there. And so it's like, well, it happened either way. Yeah. You know, so it doesn't have to, it's still in the air. I don't think the air and the atmosphere is going to care whether it was man-made or not. It was just whether it happened. Yeah. It can be quite comical, but yeah, it's definitely a pertinent and important topic right now. I mean, if you ask a lot of people, I mean, you look at the demographic or the data on people's buying decision, not buying decisions, I would say more like lifestyle decisions on pretty key things, on whether or not to start families, or, you know, whether or not they're going to be vegetarian or, you know, an omnivore. People are making some pretty big decisions based on on the feeling of how they're going to affect the environment.
By a celebrity who's saying, you know, oh, I'm doing this, but they're also getting $1 million check for doing that, saying that as well too. And nobody will listen to a farmer who's been there all their life, you know, multi-generations on their place. Even if they're first generation on their place, they're trying to do the best they possibly can. So we're getting way off topic here. Nothing to do with forages at all, but, you know, it's still something that affects the farm.
So I'll close the loop on it a little bit. So is there some, and I've heard this, let me know if it's true, but I've heard that there is some mechanisms by which, you know, the federal government is using some of that carbon tax money to incentivize soil health practices in Canada, right? So you can get paid to, you have to pay more for your diesel fuel, but then you can get paid to plant a cover crop by
you
the
apply
government.
For a grant, yes. Yeah. So you apply for a grant, depends which application you apply for. One is $150,000 over 3 years to put your pastures back into perennial legume grass stands or use cover crops in crop rotations. And that's a one-off payment. And after 3 years, then you're done. You can only apply for it once. And then there's other ones. It's only 70% of the 150,000 too, or 80%. And the other one is 70% of up to $100,000. But the lot of this too is guys are going to jump on board with this, and they're only getting half the book. So they're putting a perennial legume stand down there, and they're still going to graze it the old-fashioned way. You know, they'll open it up in the summertime, let them in there, overgraze the hell out of it, and then pull them out in the wintertime because they want the easiest thing to do. Then they should be, which some are, they're applying for the seed and electric fencing as well. And then they figure out, oh, my electric fencing isn't working. I'll go back and I'll just tear all that wire out, and they can have the whole lot the way it is there now. So, yeah, those grants are coming through. But the problem is most of the switched on operators were already doing that in the first place.
Yeah.
And so it's the new adopters who now have missed out, and it's the other people who are coming in and saying, oh, this is going to help my farm. I'll be able to get money to do this. But they're not carrying through with the whole practice. It's a whole system approach that we're trying to get. Yeah. And it's just not planting legumes or annuals and then kicking the cows out and only getting 30 days out of a quarter of land, where you could get 60 or 70 days out of a quarter of land, even more by rotations. And so some of these programs need to be paying mentors, which some of them do pay a mentor one-off. And one-off mentorship, us three come into somebody's place for a day and say, this is how you do it. Holy shit, there's a lot more to it than that too. So, yeah, and that's it's kind of what we're going through in Mongolia right now with those guys. They think everything's out of a book, and nothing, the environment's not out of a book. Mother Nature's not out of a book. We've got to be really liquid.
I'm glad you brought that up. I know we were hoping to talk about Mongolia. I think we should probably just schedule a second session, you know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks from now, and talk about Mongolia as an entire separate, because I feel like that could be an entire podcast talk about what your work over there. Yeah. Are you heading back there anytime?
Yeah, in 3 weeks I'm back there.
Okay.
Again. Go over Perfect. 2 weeks every quarter. And now I'm taking – yeah, I think I've bitten off more than I can chew because, man, they're all city guys that think, you know, it's just what we were talking about. You read in a book and that's how it's supposed to go on spreadsheets.
I did this back in 2014. I did some consulting for a large corporate farm in Northeast China that was a 100,000 hectare crop farm. It had no livestock on it other than what was to feed the little village there. A town of about 1,000 people that subsisted basically off of this one corporate farm, government farm. And they want to start a cow herd. They were going to get 10,000 head of Angus cattle and start a cow herd. And so I went over there and spent 10 days, about 2 weeks with them the first time around. And then we went to Uruguay with them and helped them out a few different times. So I've been through this a little bit before, you know, it's fun, but you also got a question. What am I doing? What are we doing here? Especially and it's like, you know, if you want to know how to help in those situations, go find your animal science 101 textbook from your first year of college, you know, with the basics in there. And that's what you got to bring, right?
Yeah, that's kind of so right there. Like, yeah, I'm looking forward to the challenge, but I've got to watch what I say because they hadn't got any of the electric fencing stuff there at the time. And I said, when it comes, just put a wire at nose height and a wire at knee height, and that'll be perfect. Well, they did exactly that. Put one at nose height and one at knee height. Wonder why the cattle weren't staying in. That was their nose and their knees, their nose, not the cattle.
Oh, boy.
But those guys, like, I'm excited for those guys because they're saying, we've watched what you guys are doing and we want to improve on that. And they're saying, so we're looking at things different, more of a dairy approach where we're going to have alfalfa silage under irrigation, and then we're going to have more grasses because the rain is not dependable over on the east side.
Okay.
And that's kind of like Saskatchewan and Alberta here. Like the guys who get this figured out, they know what works on their place. And then after a couple of years, they just ring you up and say, hey, Graham, I want X, Y, Z, and perfect, that worked for you. Yep, great. And so they've gone from going whole hog into multi-species and this and that, and they've watched what's actually growing. And out of the 15 or 20 species, there's only four or five that are dominant, and the rest you're paid for just because you're going to have them in there for soil health. So they piss that money up against the wall. So they've found out the hard way about what works and what doesn't work on their place. And people have just got to cut through the shit. They've got to start off with baby steps, figure out what works for them. You know, first, like I said, start off with a good electric fence knowledge, and then you can ramp it up from there either side on perennials or annuals.
No, that sounds good. Well, we'll catch another episode here in a couple months when you get back from your latest installment of
I'll send you some pictures.
Tour in Mongolia. That'd be great.
No, this has been good. We did cover a lot. We covered a lot of things I wanted to talk about, and so this has been fantastic. Appreciate the time, Graham.
Yep,
have a great trip to Mongolia.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you in a couple months.
Yeah. Happy farming.
All right. Yeah. Well, we hope you enjoyed another episode of the Roots and Ruminants podcast. Let us know what you thought of it. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all those social media things. And, you know, if you ever have any questions, just give us a call. We've got a toll-free number here at 888-498-7333. Be glad to hear from you. Thank you.